So last few Sundays we've been talking about secularism since the beginning of September, and each Sunday when I start, I rephrase everything that I've said so far. So just to go over it again, we have our working definition of secularism is that's the contestability of belief. Everything is up for grabs in the secular world. That in the Old Testament, we define secularism as the outer wall of the temple or businesses that the priests are involved in outside of the temple. And in the New Testament, the word secular means the world or this age. So both in Scripture, we can see how secularism starts at the temple, and then by the New Testament, it's going out to the world. And that's kind of interesting. Not drawing any comparisons or saying this is true, but it kind of seems to mirror how we see the gospel as well. It starts at the temple with sacrifice and then goes out to the world. So we kind of see a mirror in that in our definition of secularism. And we've talked about how the secular man is under pressure, that he receives pressure both from this haunting of religion and this internal feeling that there's something more, while at the same time living in a culture that tells him this is all there is, that by being told that science is the new religion, and that if you can't prove it in an equation, you can't demonstrate it, then it must not be true. So that's the, we talked about that man, that secular man. Then we've talked about worship practices and how the secular worship. Last week we used two examples of TED Talks and the Burning Man as examples, pretty extreme examples, but examples of worship practices. But we've also talked about other worship practices along our way, even what we might call the secular... can't get the word. The way they worship. Sorry. I'm at a loss. Can't draw it. Liturgy. There we go. Sorry. That wasn't there. Yeah, we talked about secular liturgies and how those secular liturgies, we see them whether we're in the mall or whether we engage with each other in society or we watch television or you have a sports game. There are secular liturgies that we see all over the place. And that's part of secular worship. So we see that all through that secular worship, even though they wouldn't call it that, if we look at it and we take it apart for what it is, yes, they do have their own liturgies, their own worship. So today, we're going to get contesting the secular idea. Now we're getting into we've defined the problem, we've taken it apart, we've seen where they struggle. Now we're going to talk about how we contest it. And that's what we'll go into over the next coming weeks. So what I'd like to start with is I'll start with us, what we say, and then I'm going to read a little bit about what they're thinking. So if we look at, and this morning was for our profession of faith, it was a perfect, it leads right into what I was going to say this morning, is that first question of the Westminster Catechism. What are we formed to do? We're formed to love God and enjoy Him forever. That's what we believe life is. Or if you take the Heidelberg Catechism, it's what is my only comfort in life and death? That I am not my own, but belong body and soul to the Lord Jesus Christ. In both cases, the flourishing is described as something that's outside of us. Flourishing is something bigger. It's something larger. And if we go back to that First Peter text from this morning, it's being in communion with Christ. So it's something from outside. And the definition of that isn't our bodily or material flourishing, but our spiritual flourishing that finds itself outside of itself, if that makes sense. So what does the secular world say? I have a short article here from Psychology Today, which is a very well-known theological journal. Philosophers throughout history have held the idea of authenticity in high esteem, but few psychologists have taken it seriously until recently, when positive psychologists turned to understanding human flourishing. First, there is our outer authenticity, how well what we say and do matches what is really going on inside of us. Second, there is our inner authenticity, how well we actually know ourselves and are aware of our inner states. No one is fully authentic all the time in their outer presentation. Sometimes we need to put on an act to get by. But some people spend more time living inauthentically than others. It is unpleasant and damaging to us if we are trapped in jobs or relationships where we rarely get the chance to be ourselves. So then he has a few questions here. How much of the time do you feel that you can be the real you? Are you easily influenced by other people? Do you always stand up for what you believe in? What are the barriers to being yourself? How well do you know yourself? Well, as Reformed people, I think we have an answer to what our inner self is, and it's not good. And that's kind of what we're going to talk about today after we kind of dissect how we contest secularization. So I'm going to use our author, Professor Smith, uses a different word, but I'm going to use something that some of you may be familiar with. Cornelius Van Til was a well-known philosopher and theologian within Reformed circles, and he used the term presuppositionalism. And can anyone tell me what presuppositionalism is? Anyone? No? It's what you think before you think. So it's what you're thinking. It's that architecture, that scaffolding that makes up the way you think and is going to form what you think before you even start. So we all have them. We all have these, and a lot of them are based on our experiences, on our culture, the way we were raised. All of that stuff makes up the scaffolding. And we have them as Christians, and a lot of it has to do with, for instance, how we understand church, how we behave, how we think about God, how we think about ourselves, and all of that is built into this scaffolding. Well, the secular world has one too. So we're just going to throw these out here. What are some secular presuppositions, do you think, dealing with secular people, the things that they're just kind of assuming? Okay, the material. The material. Okay, so we'll say materialism. This is it. The truth is within ourselves. Man is the measure. Be true to thyself. Relativism. Good nature. Anything else? Yes, sir. Happiness. You know, there's an interesting thing. A little sidebar question for everyone. Happiness shows up in one of our great American documents, right? The pursuit of happiness. First question, yes or no question. Did the writers of that document understand happiness to be the same word we understand happiness to be? No. What did they understand? Anyone know what they understood it? Well, there's that. Does anyone know what they understood that to mean? It comes from Greek philosophy, and it basically means everything in balance. Happiness was not a state of joy. It wasn't a state of excitement. It wasn't like, hey, I got the bank account's full and we're gone on vacation. No, happiness meant everything was just where it should be. We have enough food. We have enough money. We have our house is big enough for us. Our car is getting us around. That was happiness in the Greek ideal, and it's how the founders understood happiness. But then somewhere along the line, that changed. So when they talk about the pursuit of happiness today, like you mentioned, their understanding of what that word means, completely different than what the originators meant and what philosophy would understand that to mean. The secular world understands happiness as I'm content with myself and my pursuits. So happiness, that's an awesome word. Anyone else?
You could add here that there is a God who's way far away.
Deism, like we talked about. And I'll put a star next to that because even that might be contestable for some of them. Spirituality? Yeah. It's non-judgmental. Okay, so we have, these are our, how we see it. Let's kind of go into what they see. Well, actually, let me ask you another question first before we move on. Is there a difference when we look at, say, a missionary who gives up everything to move to Zimbabwe, Costa Rica, embraces a level of poverty and scarcity that we don't have living here? What's our presuppositions about them? What are our presuppositions about him or her or them?
I was actually a missionary in Ecuador for 30 years, and I was in the middle class compared to everybody around me.
Right.
So I didn't think I was giving up that.
But compared to us back here in...
Oh, yeah, I didn't have the hurt.
Right.
Kind of a Mother Mary.
Yeah, I mean, there is this bit of a Mother Teresa perspective, depending on the situation, right? So my in-laws were missionaries in Haiti for over 30 years as well. The situation they were in, they lived fairly well compared to Haitians. They had a generator and an inverter, and they had, you know, they could afford drinking water. They had a maid. I mean, but they didn't have much money. But because of what little money they had, they could actually live fairly well in Haiti. But there were people that were even worse off than they were, that were living out in the bush, especially the guys that work with places like Wycliffe Bible translators and stuff like that, where they have to actually go out into some pretty harsh realities. But when we look at them as Christians, we tend to see, we admire them. We think about, you know, how great, you know, what a wonderful person this is, how God has worked in their lives to be able to go out and actually do something like this. And then that causes us to inwardly reflect on our position. Yes, sir. Yeah, I mean, there is a bit of sainthood, maybe. I mean, when we look at certain guys, you know, certain people, kind of from a Catholic perspective. But then think about, and this is just a mental exercise, think about how the secular world would look at somebody who gives up everything they have here in order to move to, like, friends of Hanukkah's family moved to Irian Jaya near Papua New Guinea to actually live up with the tribal people in order to translate the Bible into their local language. There is no electricity. There is no running water. You are living in a mud floor hut for years on end just to develop the relationship with the people in order to learn the language to finally translate the Bible before, you know, I mean, we're 4 steps behind what we're thinking. So we have a perception of those kind of people, but the secular world does as well. And to a large extent, it's pity. I mean, they kind of pity people like that. So this kind of gives us, if you keep that in mind as we talk about the way the secular world thinks and we think about it in terms of that missionary who goes off to that harsh reality. And the way we perceive them as opposed to the way the secular world perceives.
Trying to bring us back to what you have on the board there.
Correct.
The secular view, and a perfect example I can think of that is, I was talking to a friend talking about a couple of young women that they weren't sisters, but mm-hmm. they moved together in college. Mm-hmm. They went away to college with each other, and when they were in college, they came to be believers. They were involved with different ministries and decided that when they graduated from college, they wanted to go and do that kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
The one girl's parents were fairly wealthy, and when she came home and explained to them that this is what she was going to do for a few years, they were just at a loss.
A St. Francis of Assisi moment right there.
You have this wonderful education.
Right.
You can go out and get a job. You can start looking for a husband. You can start to build a family. You're not going to have anything. You're going to waste this education that you've
right.
got. It was all about, this can't possibly make you happy. This can't possibly give you anything.
Right.
And it was a secular.
Right.
The presupposition that they have about what you're supposed to do.
About what flourishing, looks like.
What does flourishing look like?
Right, exactly. So, seculars have three, sorry, ma'am. Did you have a comment? I'm sorry.
I would say, expectation is they want to, if they long for to pursue their vocation.
Right. Yeah, they're calling. Yeah. It's the idea of calling, you know? Yeah. So seculars basically have three presuppositions according to our author. He says religion, one of them is religion must decline because it is false, and science shows this to be so. So I think we have that up here. It is increasingly irrelevant. So irrelevance kind of fits in some of these as well. And the example here is artificial fertilizers make atheists, is the concept. So as technology improves and as we can make life easier for people to lead, that eventually will make people atheists because they feel that they can do it themselves. So that argument is the artificial fertilizers make atheists argument. And lastly, that religion is based on authority, and modern society places individual autonomy over authority. So we have authority within the church. We have elders. We have church documents. We have church councils at higher levels. We have various amounts of authority that we submit to as members of the church. To the secular world, this idea runs counter to personal autonomy, that I, man is the measure, and to a certain extent, relativism. If I have personal autonomy, how am I going to submit myself to a bunch of guys who wear funny robes? I mean, how can I do that? We have a conflict here. So these are the three. Religion must decline because it is false, and science shows this to be so. It is increasingly irrelevant because we don't really need it like we used to. And religion is based on authority, and modern society places individual autonomy over authority. So some combination of these three leads to the secular assumption that religion cannot be a true motivator for human action. So they take those three things and they kind of say, this is what religion is, and this can't really truly be why people want to do what they do. So I got another word. Conspiracy. So, and that's a loaded term. But let me break this down. So the folks that are at the highest levels of our society, you know, your professors, your people in some levels of government, in some levels of in think tanks, in high society, especially in the coastal areas, they really work on the assumption that religion can't really be the motivator for why people believe what they believe. Because it doesn't make sense. They can't contextualize it. To put it in different terms, it'd be like how someone living in New York City can't understand how someone living in Sierra Vista, Arizona could want to own a shotgun. There's no point of reference. They don't know what, they couldn't tell you what time of the year deer season is, because there's no contextualization. We find the same thing with these, especially the seculars. When I say seculars, I'm talking about those true believers in secularism, is they cannot possibly understand that what I believe about God and my relationship to Him can motivate what I do on a day-to-day basis. Does not make sense to them. So in turn, what it becomes is kind of a conspiracy about power. There's a like the last point, that religion is based on authority, and modern society places autonomy above authority. Well, then that authority must be trying to do something. Someone's looking for power. And that's what creates a problem, because the conversation that exists between us as believers and the unbeliever, especially the secular unbeliever, gets mixed, because their assumptions about us, their presuppositions, are that there's another reason for why we're saying what we're saying. Does that make sense to everybody? It's a lot of words. Okay. So, let's talk about, move a bit into religion. And when I say religion, this is just the broad term for society, but we can replace that with Christianity. But Christianity is transformational. It transforms people. It changes people. It's more than just axioms and propositions that we put on a board that look really fancy and smart talk by a bunch of 10,000-pound brains. It actually transforms people's lives, and it's a way of life lived. And that's what becomes where we start creating difficulties for the secular world. That's where we become problematic, because we're saying that we are living a life well lived that is more than worldly flourishing. So I was talking with Pastor about the shooting this past week, and about this young man who was neither flourishing according to worldly standards, nor did he have a conception of who God was and who he was in relation to God. So this has put him in a tough position. We have a guy who is not flourishing. He does not, the girls don't like him. He doesn't have money. Wasn't apparently the sharpest tool in the shed. And he's not making the cut. He's not making it. And at the same time, he sees people who reject worldly flourishing. He sees in the church people who say, I reject that as the standard for how I judge what is right and wrong, good and bad, and if I'm on the right track. So is it any surprise then, should it surprise us, that someone would pick up a gun and shoot someone who said that, who was struggling to flourish, who had deep, deep, deep-seated issues with flourishing? He wasn't making it. There's people out there in society, because our voice is not unheard. We have to remember that. The voice of the church is not unheard. And we're telling the world that our version of flourishing is what God tells us flourishing really means, and that we are in opposition to worldly flourishing. And here we have really a problem. This goes back to that cross-pressuring that people feel. And in this case, it turned out someone used a gun because of that pressure, because of that transcendent big idea pressure and the material pressure on them. And it ended the way it ended. So we believe that worldly flourishing is more, that Christian flourishing is more than just worldly flourishing, that there's something else. So what is the something else?
The answer, I can give you a hint. I already gave you the answer in the beginning.
Anyone? No? No? Question one, Westminster. To love God? Love God? Enjoy God? Glorify God? Communion. Kind of here with glorify Him, exalt. I didn't spell that right. E-X-A-U. There we go. What else is Christian flourishing? Suffering, sorry, sir? Self-denial, suffering.
I think suffering well.
Ma'am? Oh, that I, with body and soul, both in life and death, am not my own, but heaven, who by His precious blood hath fully satisfied for all my sins and delivered me from the power of the devil, and so preserves me that not a hair can fall from my head except by the will of my Father in heaven. That part? Sorry, I was trying to think through it. Yeah. That's question number one. That us Dutchies all learn when we're little kids. It's drilled into us. Yeah, well. So, yeah, it's this idea that I am not my own. And this is how, and that's part of flourishing too, isn't it? When we get to that I am not my own. It's that old saying that, you know, the first step is to admit there is God and I am not Him. Right? So this is a short list, but generally what we see is Christian flourishing. And it's transformational. This changes who people are. Worldly flourishing doesn't change who people are. Worldly flourishing, I mean, it can, but it's really only changing in one direction, generally. It's pointing down. Absolutely. Correct. Correct. So, seculars find not only the supernatural implausible, but also pursuing a way of life beyond human flourishing implausible. And remember, when they're saying human flourishing, we've already talked about what that means. So to say that we as Christians are pursuing a life that looks towards godly flourishing, Christian flourishing, is implausible, because the only possible flourishing there is worldly flourishing. So basically, we're talking nonsense as far as the secular world is concerned. Because what we are proposing cannot exist if we go back to those three assumptions that they make. Those three assumptions make the idea of Christian flourishing impossible. Because we've got the power issue, we have the irrelevance issue, and we've had the science rationality issue. And because of those things, what we're talking about is nonsense. So it's ultimately nonsensical. So this leads me to that article I started with, in that the secular world, excuse my spelling, sometimes I mess it up as I'm going too quick, is
an age of authenticity. The age of authenticity. The importance of living out one's own life as opposed to living it in conformity. Living in conformity. What do we kind of, as the church, kind of demand conformity in a certain way, don't we? I mean, we wouldn't, there's some behaviors that we don't accept. And this is where, again, we're getting to the problem. If authenticity is an expression of individuality, I'm an individual, and it gets lived out in the culture such as it is. So what happens is people learn those liturgies of the secular world. There's a certain way to dress. There's a certain way to behave. There's a certain way to speak and how we relate to one another. And it becomes demonstration art, if you will, to the point where basically people in the secular world have all become 13-year-old girls. Because it's all, I don't mean to demean 13-year-old girls that way, but you get what I'm saying. And that's actually a quote from the author as well. He says, we're basically, the secular world is basically a bunch of 13-year-old girls. Because it has its own conformity. But the conformity is voluntary, and that's the difference, is they're unwilling to accept that they're being told what to do. So they want to behave in a certain way, yet it's a consumer society. We give people the idea that they have choice, right? Choice in a consumer society is kind of not really there, right? But they still have it. As long as we have the idea that I am making the choice, that I am making the decision, then the secular world is cool with that. And whether that's food, clothes, other products, one of the examples, which is a great example that the author uses, is of the teenage kid who has his mom buy him a skateboard with anarchy symbols on it that cost $150. And how this is kind of in conflict. Anarchy, $150 brand name skateboard seems to be at cross purposes. It's just like when I was in high school, there was a kid who was quite wealthy, but was trying to do the grunge thing. So he would park the Land Rover that his dad bought him. And at the time it was a 1996 Land Rover, which was a brand new or a year old. He'd park it around the corner. He didn't want any of us to know that he had it. And he'd come slumming out in his grunge clothes so that he had the perception. It was all voluntary. He chose to behave like that. So, and you could see the applications of this in other areas too. Right. Who made that choice for him? And to pretend, the act of pretending was voluntary. Now, if he was actually a poor surfer in California, or a poor skateboarder, or just poor in general, the secular world would count that as loss, because that wasn't voluntary. He didn't choose to behave that way. Whereas in the Christian world, we actually look at the poor with esteem. But the secular world would not, unless you chose to be that way, and then that's cool. So, anything goes. Right. As long as it's authentic, as long as you are being true to thyself, then it's okay. So how long has tolerance been a Western value? Anyone? The generally accepted OED definition, that I am tolerant of your behaviors and you are tolerant of mine, that... we can go back to Adam Smith. We can go back to the early modern era and find tolerance as being an idea, especially within philosophers who talked about capitalism in the early days of capitalism. But we see this idea of tolerance.
That idea of tolerance also included the ability to still be able to say, I can tolerate that view from you, but I still see it as being wrong.
Correct.
The modern day idea of tolerance is you have to accept whatever I lay out there and you're not allowed to tell me.
Correct. And what we ended up having was back then when all of these early philosophers in early modern era were talking, was they put tolerance within a larger structure. They had a larger structure within which to understand it. And that larger structure is gone. Christianity provided a large measure of that. Western culture provided a large measure of that. But then going back to what Mark said, in the 60s, we did see a lot of that larger structure demolished.
Well, I think in the 60s in Britain, the modern notion of tolerance, which is coupled with the ethic of autonomy, is it?
Mm-hmm. So being authentic, and I have to be tolerant so long as you're being authentic.
Or you must be tolerant because I'm being authentic.
Okay. And I think in some ways, in the past, that would have been acceptable so long as it was within the structure of Christianity, Western values and mores, all of that other stuff that we valued and that we as the church still hold to. It would have been okay. But once we got rid of all of that, then being authentic and being tolerant became difficult because now I had to be tolerant of someone whose behaviors I found reprehensible, which formerly would have been understood as not acceptable.
They did take Christian values for granted, and that's how a lot of it worked for such a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's social byproducts of
authenticity. Right. And the question now that hopefully within the last 10 minutes I can answer is how do we deal with that? How do we deal with that authenticity in the secular world that it strives after? The tolerance that's being enforced upon us. How do we deal with that as the church in the culture? And here's an interesting idea that our author presents, as he says that while our culture may create a framework of individualism, so it's this authenticity coupled with that tolerance, it does not necessarily follow that the content of faith is individualistic. So we actually live in a culture now where we have individualism, but that the faith that person may eventually accept, like all of us sitting in this room, is not an individualist faith. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's still hope. Because the individualist faith is not the one that we look at in this building. But a person can be an individual and still accept a faith that requires stuff of them, such as Christianity. So that's the road we're driving down.
I think one other angle of that authenticity thing, though, too, is the idea that because I believe I'm authentic, you can't question.
Mm-hmm.
And the only problem with that is if someone walks in here authentically believing that they can walk into this room and slap you in the face and walk out, that'll probably work until they decide to do that for the President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're going to find themselves in an entirely different situation. So that authenticity just flies right out the window,
right,
in the face of what's really true about the situation they're in.
Right. So where we find ourselves then is, we were talking about Burning Man last week, is if you have a group like an organization, an event like Burning Man, you can have people that are rabid about being authentic and rabid about being tolerant. Yet, like we know from those professors at Wheaton, there are people that are searching out for meaning. And the problem that they're going to run into, and this is where we as the church step in, is that meaning will always require something of someone. You don't get to have meaning without something being required of you. Does that make sense? So in that way, we actually need just to learn how to speak to them. How to speak to them. So I'm going to try and finish up with my last few thoughts here. The next thing that our author says is it's the Christian's reality, and this is harsh, that the old days are never coming back, and the age of authenticity is here to stay. We choose in an age of authenticity to renounce the priority of individual choice. This is countercultural. The church is countercultural. The church has become the hippies of the modern age because we are renouncing what the culture is telling us. And that's something that we have to recognize. We are not the culture anymore. This goes back to what Pastor was saying this morning. We are back with Peter. So committed secularism remains the creed of a relatively small minority. If you want to find committed secularists, I can give you my New York Times from this morning, and you can find them in the op-ed section. There are committed secularists there. But by and large, you're not going to meet a committed secularist on the street. What you're going to meet are people that are in that pressured zone, that have questions about both the reality of materialism and science and what they're being told on the Discovery Channel, and at the same time, the realities that they feel every day walking around, that there is a God, that He is there, that there's something bigger than us. Those are the people that you're going to meet, and those are the people we have to have an answer for. Luckily, our past is irrevocably Christian. What we can't change, what they can't change, is that the culture we live in is directly related to our Christian heritage. That even though we stand where we do in a culture that has repudiated much of what Christianity believes, it can't change history. So even though the old days are never coming back, which reminds me of a Bruce Springsteen song, the reality is that those old days will always influence where we are now. The old days are always going to influence them. It's going to haunt them. And like we've talked about before, it's going to haunt them when the most meaningful elements of life pop up. It's going to haunt them when their children are born. It's going to haunt them when they get married. It'll haunt them when they die. It'll haunt them when they stand at the Grand Canyon. And that will continue. There's no way that they can override that. So we have to. So what our job is at the church now is to figure out how we deal with that. That feeling is like the FM station from Tucson that you can kind of pick up every once in a while when you get quite far away. It fades in and out. And that's that feeling that these folks have. It's never strong, but they pick it up every once in a while as they're driving along, and they can hear that song they remember. And that song they remember brings up emotions and history and thoughts that they've had in the past. Our job is to understand what that feeling is. It's very easy for us to make declarations and axioms and set forth propositions in very logical matters. But the reality is that they don't have the radio on and they don't have a good signal. So how do we remember, get them to remember those songs? That's where we're at. So, I know that's kind of depressing, but it's the reality of the world we live in. So, I'd like to do in the coming weeks, we're going to get into the conclusion of how not to be secular. That should take two or three more weeks. And then, so long as it's okay with the elders, I'm going to look into something called resentment, which is the French version of the word resentment. And resentment is what happens when someone realizes that they don't make the measure. It is what happens to people when they are not flourishing, both either in a worldly way or in a godly way, and resentment develops. And that affects the way that we talk to other people. It affects the way that those who are poor talk to those who are rich. It affects the way that those who are lacking in some ways talk to other ways that are flourishing in other ways. And that resentment is what we find in the secular world. And that's what causes a lot of the problems that we see. So hopefully we'll... Correct. Resentment. Mm-hmm. That's exactly true.
And I don't even know how they necessarily relate them, but you had said that people live under pressure. And I was reminded of this young man that I had an opportunity to be with, and I said to him, do you ever consider And he said that he did, and we had this great conversation, but people do actually consider these things. I mean, they are thinking these thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And finding out what is going through their mind does give us opportunity to hold out hope in those areas. And there's a woman I just talked to yesterday who has so far beat cancer in remission. I said, and she doesn't have a faith. And I said, how did you get through it? And her response is, it was awful, it was horrible, and I just, every day, one day at a time. But there was no afterthought of that. You know, it was awful, it was horrible suffering, but through it, God did this.
Mm-hmm.
What God did. There was no final testimony of how God comforted her or how the church embraced her. It was just.
It's putting your head down and nugging your way through it, that's it. And that's how, now, I mean, with the cancer, that's quite an extreme, but that's how the secular world lives its day to day life. It's putting your head down, muscling, nugging your way through it, and hoping that in the end it all works out. And with no idea what flourishing, of a greater flourishing. Yeah, hold fast. So let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you that you work in our lives, that you work in our hearts and our minds, transforming us, reforming us into the people you want us to be. We thank you, Lord, that you have given us a true measure of flourishing, that we can see that in our lives, in the lives of our children, in the lives of our family, and in the lives of those that we commune with at church. We ask, Lord, that you would help us to articulate this flourishing to a world that is dying, to a world that is in need of grace in the gospel. We ask that you would be with us through the coming week, that you would give us opportunities to share the gospel, and that through that we might worship and glorify you. We ask that you give us the words to speak this week and the strength to act in accordance with your will. We ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen.